You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 6th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ari Berman of The Nation on his latest piece in Rolling Stone magazine, Republicans, their long march to dismantle democracy. That and more with Ari Berman. Of course, the big story from last Friday, President Obama's EPA rollback. A new poll out. Looks like liberals are not the only ones who are involved in magical thinking. According to John Chiat of the New Republic. Regulations, do they kill jobs? No. I'll have more on that. Anonymous planning some type of action on September 17th. Department of Homeland Security, they're nervous about it. Europe, everybody's nervous about Europe. And more. A lot of stories today, folks. Back live. And it's a pleasure to be back. I spent the long weekend combing fleas out of the cats. And I made them a nice little window in which they can look out at the rain. But not while they have fleas. Then they must go outside. Let's get right into this before we get to Ari Berman. This is a story that was breaking on Friday, just as I went on. So we mentioned it, didn't cover it as much as it warrants. But the EPA has been planning to come out with new regulations basically involving the amount of pollutants factories can put into the air. You'll recall that the Bush administration dropped these requirements below a, I guess, medical and, in fact, a legally defensible number. The Bush level was 60 to 70 parts per billion in terms of the pollutants. And I'm sorry, the Bush administration set the standard at 75 parts per billion in 2008. All the scientists involved in the EPA say that for health reasons, it needs to be 60 to 70 parts per billion. In 2010, the EPA chief Lisa Jackson announced she would set the standard between 60 and 70 parts per billion, as she's legally required to do. The Supreme Court has said that the EPA is not allowed, not only can overrule, but is not allowed, and this is a 2001 Supreme Court decision, allowed to take costs into account when setting the ozone standards. The agency estimated that compliance costs for the industry could range from $19 billion to $90 billion a year by 2020. However, it would yield health benefits worth $13 to $100 billion. other studies have showed that, in fact, all the retrofitting that would have to take place, although it would take place over the course of the next probably a 2 to 5 year window, would actually increase the GDP. So this is not a situation where this was going to cost any money or kill any jobs or cost the economy any money. Would it cost specific operators money? Yes. And it would make other people money, in addition to the fact that we would have less people dying and having severe medical problems. But the Obama administration, as they gear up their big jobs speech on Thursday, has decided to capitulate. I don't know. You know, you want to call it capitulation? You want to call it whatever it is. I mean, they're overruling their own EPA on this. So presumably somebody in the White House knows more about these things than the EPA does. And they are doing this to basically send the message, I guess, to Republicans or independents who, according to the latest polls, are not interested in what President Obama has to offer, regardless of what it is. They are trying to signal that, hey, we're your friends. Love us. Please love us. Vote for us in 2012. And it's not working, as polls that we will discuss later have shown. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the wonderful and charming Ari Berman from The Nation magazine on his piece in Rolling Stone magazine. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program Ari Berman. So nice, so wonderful, so smart. Ari has written a great piece in Rolling Stone magazine, on loan from The Nation, The Long March to Dismantle Democracy, or the GOP's war on voting, I should say, which is a long march to dismantle democracy. Ari, now this is something that first off, welcome.
Sam, it's always a pleasure and a highlight of my week to talk to you.
Oh, really? Well, I'm glad I got this
off. I sit by my email all day and just wait for you to email me.
There you go. There you go. There's many others who could say the same thing. Now, we have known for ages that Republicans feel and have stated explicitly, I think you mentioned Paul Weyrich's famous proclamation that when less people vote, we do better in terms of Republicans.
Yeah.
And we know that whether it was in 2000 or 2004, there was ongoing Republican machinations like caging. Some Republican operatives in New Hampshire were actually sent to jail for their trying to Democratic get out the vote operations. We know that guys like the Secretary of State of Ohio you know, made sure that there was not enough polling places in Ohio in Democratic districts so that people would be thwarted by long lines. Your piece now outlines what seems to be the next level, almost the professionalization of this.
Yeah. Well, what it is it's so unprecedented. I mean, you really have to go back to the pre-Voting Rights Act era to a time when one party has been so open and clear about trying to discriminate against certain groups of voters. So, yes, Republicans have been trying to do this for a while, but what they've been able to do since the 2010 election, thanks to their large majorities in state after state after state, is to pass a ton of different laws, not all the same, but taken together, they really discriminate against the very voters who elected Barack Obama in 2008, young people, blacks, Hispanics. And really, the GOP has tried, and I think has some success, a significant amount of success, in shaping the electorate for 2012. So it doesn't matter whether the economy gets better. It doesn't matter whether Barack Obama does better in the polls. It doesn't matter if the Republicans nominate Mitt Romney or Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann. They want to ensure that the electorate they have in 2012 is an electorate that favors the Republicans. And I don't think we've seen this far in advance an attempt by a party to shape an electorate like this in a very, very long time.
Yeah, and so these like smaller things that were done, let's say, in Ohio, we're going to shape the electorate by making sure that like new voters can't register because their card stock in which they wrote their thing on, you know, wasn't the proper thickness. Or we're not going to put enough voting mechanisms, voting machines in certain districts. Now we have something that's coordinated, and this has been in the works for years, and it comes out of all of this legislation comes out of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and they've been waiting for this opportunity.
They've been waiting for this opportunity. So if you go back, to the founding of ALEC in 1973 by Paul Weyrich, a very influential conservative right activist. You hear Weyrich, as you said earlier, saying, "I don't want everybody to vote." As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down. So that's really the mantra for all these efforts that come out. In 2005, Indiana passed the photo ID bill that was upheld by the Supreme Court in 2008, and that really opened the floodgates for ALEC. They were able to draft legislation based on the Indiana law, and after the 2010 election, they finally had their majorities so they could distribute this state by state by state. And so you saw what happened in January 2011 when these new GOP legislators and governors came in. They didn't introduce legislation to boost the economy. They introduced legislation to make it harder for Democrats to vote. This was their stealth agenda, and it had been their stealth agenda all along. Some Republicans talked openly about it, but many did not. And what happened is Democrats came in to these legislators with much smaller majorities, and they found all these photo ID bills, all these different bills to make it harder to vote in the being considered on emergency track. So basically there was nothing the opposition party could do. These things were steamrolled through in a number of different states. So we had legislation introduced in 38 states, and 12 states passed these laws thus far. So that's pretty significant. I mean, a dozen states, including a number of major battlegrounds, majorly changing their election laws for 2012.
Now, let's lay the predicate here. I mean, what is their justification for, let's say, the voter voter ID laws?
Yeah. Well, their justification for voter ID laws, I should say, first thing, there's four major ways that they've tried to suppress the Democratic vote, making it harder to register to vote, cutting back on early voting, which the Obama campaign used very successfully in 2008, requiring these photo IDs, and then preventing ex-felons who have served their time from voting. And so the photo ID justification is basically that there is rampant voter fraud. That's been their mantra for all of these laws. They point to Acorn as the latest example in what they believe is a long plot by Democrats to steal elections. And basically, they've argued that voter fraud is so widespread that you have to be able to show an ID, and that's the only way to preserve the sanctity of American elections. Now, there's a few problems with that argument. The first problem is that voter fraud, in-person voter impersonation. So me saying I'm Sam Cedar, I want to go vote for Michelle Bachmann in the next election. I know that's how you're voting. I would already, under the Help America Vote Act, if I was a first-time voter, number one, I would have to show some proof of ID, whether it's an electricity bill, et cetera, et cetera. Number two is the fact that this type of fraud doesn't really exist, in-person voter impersonation. There was a study by the Brennan Center for Justice that found that a voter is more likely to be struck by lightning than they are to impersonate another voter at the polls. So voter fraud, as we know it, doesn't exist. The type of voter fraud that is more common is absentee ballots. And that's the type of thing in voting by mail. That's the type of thing that actually benefits Republicans, because older voters and members of the military tend to vote by mail, tend to vote absentee, and there's nothing in these laws that actually makes it more difficult for that. So you're seeing they're cracking down under a purported threat of voter fraud only on certain types of non-existent voter fraud that will just lead to Democratic voters not being able to vote in the next election.
So the type of voter fraud that we know statistically is virtually non-existent. I think there were something like you quoted, there were something like 80 cases of this over the course of almost an 8-year period. 80 cases nationwide. Now, I suppose if all those people were in Palm Beach, but 80 cases nationwide over the course of a 10-year period, and they mostly involved people who had just mistakenly registered, or there was no clear intent to defraud, because of course this would be one of the stupidest crimes. How could you get? Presumably you'd have to get sort of round up all these, people who didn't have the right to vote. So you'd have to round up a bunch of undocumented aliens, immigrants, and then organize them in such a way, send them out to different. The amount of money, it's just logistically impossible to pull this off, particularly on a federal election level.
It's absurd. And the Justice Department, you have to remember, they prosecuted 86 people between 2002 and 2007. And this was a top priority for the Justice Department. Alberto Gonzalez, John Ashcroft, Karl Rove, this was a high, high, high priority for them. So you think that they would be doing everything they could to try to prosecute these cases. And still, they only found 86 cases, and most of them were people voting who didn't realize they could vote. It wasn't any sort of malicious plot to steal an election. It was more likely honest mistakes, either by poll workers or by ex-felons, for example, or immigrants who didn't realize they were ineligible to vote. But Republicans take these statistics and then they make it out to be this enormous deal. They take the case of Acorn, which has been hyped and exaggerated beyond belief. But even if you go back to Acorn, for example, an Acorn person registering as Mickey Mouse doesn't mean they're going to be able to vote as Mickey Mouse under the polls. They would have to provide, if they're a first-time voter, they would have to already provide an electricity bill, for example, saying that they are Mickey Mouse, which I think would require a whole lot of ingenuity, even by a group as supposedly creative and nefarious as Acorn. And really what this is Republicans looked at what the Obama campaign did well in 2008. They did well at registering new voters. They did well at turning out voters early. They did well at turning out voters who don't always vote, young people, some minority segments. And that's specifically who these laws target. It's no coincidence that in states like Wisconsin, it's students who are discriminated against. It's no coincidence that in states like Florida, it's African-American voters who are discriminated against. This is obviously, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, as Bill Clinton said, to figure out what's going on here.
What's the problem with voter ID? You have nothing to hide. Why not just show your federally issued or your state issued ID?
Yeah. Well, there's two major problems. The first problem is the fact that 10% of U.S. citizens don't have this ID. So the idea that everyone has it is actually not true. And that number is much higher among young people. 18% don't have it, and African Americans, 25% don't have it. So we're talking about a pretty large percentage of voters and U.S. citizens who don't have this ID. That's number one.
Statistically, it almost goes without saying, because people know this, young people and African Americans are far more likely to vote Democratic than they are Republican.
Yeah. And the second problem with that is these laws are drafted in such a way to purposely disenfranchise groups of voters who actually have ID. So, for example, in Wisconsin, every student in Wisconsin has a student ID, right? They could use that ID in previous elections to vote. Now what's happening is the law has been written in such a way that students can only vote if their IDs include a current address, a birth date, a signature, and a two-year expiration date. And those are things that no college or university ID currently meets. So basically, the law is written in such a way that 242,000 students in Wisconsin don't have the right documentation now to vote, even though they are registered voters, even though they are U.S. citizens, and even though they had what would previously be considered an acceptable photo ID. So it's not just the fact that people don't have them, it's the fact that the law has been written in such a way to actually discriminate voters who should have the right ID. And that's where these laws get so tricky and nefarious.
So the ID is one element. The other one is they're cutting back on early voting. What possible problem could there be? What possible justification is there for eliminating or narrowing the time period of early voting? I mean, because we know this actually helped make the voting process smoother. It obviously encouraged more people to vote. It cuts down on the chance for electoral fraud. What's the justification?
The justification in certain states has just been money, has been the fact that they claim that early voting costs too much money, which is sort of ironic because Republicans in a lot of states are introducing these new photo ID laws and other changes to the election are actually going to cost their states a lot of money because what's going to happen is they have to open more DMV offices, they have to train more election workers, they have to provide these IDs at least theoretically for free so that's not considered a poll tax. And so really, if you look at the push state by state by state to actually change the electorate for 2012, it's going to cost a lot more money than it's going to save by cutting back on early voting in places like Florida and Ohio. I mean, there probably was some justification in Ohio for perhaps cutting it back a little bit because you had 35 days and now you have 11 days. I could see maybe you could cut it back to 21 days. But cutting it on the Sunday before the election, when black voters historically mobilized their constituents, which is what Florida did and what Ohio did, I mean, it's hard to justify that economically. I mean, if that just looks to me like pure politics, plain and simple, trying to suppress the turnout of a group of people that historically vote for Democrats in large numbers.
I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but I mean, if it is the case, you know, you say the ID must be provided free, otherwise it is a poll tax. Couldn't someone sue and say, like, look, I'm getting a driver's license because I want to vote, and I don't want to pay these fees?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. In Wisconsin, for example, the driver's license, not the driver's license, but the free photo ID is free. So if you say, I need an ID to vote, it's free. The problem is, in Wisconsin, they don't even advertise that, so people don't even know. And there was one documented case on video where a mother went in with her son, and they asked for a bank statement, and then they said his bank account didn't have enough activity to justify getting the ID. There was nothing in the law that said that it was legal for someone to check the activity on a bank account and determine whether or not someone should vote. And that's just one of the many ways that you've been to a DMV, Sam. I've been to a DMV. They're not always the most well-run places. Now you can imagine that they are now responsible for a ton of new voters. Hundreds of thousands of voters across the country are going to have to go to the DMV to try to get these IDs. It's going to create mass chaos, and you're going to have a lot of incompetent DMV workers who are giving people bad advice. These laws are structured in a way that they're already complicated. For example, in South Carolina, 178,000 South Carolinians don't have the ID necessary to vote now. To get that free ID, they have to show, for example, a passport or a birth certificate. If they don't have a passport or a birth certificate, some of these elderly black residents in the state are going to have to go to family court to prove that they are who they say they are. And so you get in this crazy scenario where someone could actually obtain a fake birth certificate, which is an actually real source of voter fraud, in order to legally vote. And that's just a crazy scenario that could actually happen in the next election. And I just think that one of the reasons that these laws have been passed and the way they've been passed is to try to create confusion among the electorate, to make it so complicated that people can't even figure out if they can vote, and thus they'll just stay home.
And of course, they're also the other pillar of this program is to make it harder just to register people.
Absolutely. I mean, you have two different things going on here. Number one, you have it more difficult for people to register to vote. You have states like Kansas, Alabama, and Tennessee requiring birth certificates to register to vote, a proof of citizenship, which a very serious number of Americans do not have ready access to. And then you have other states like Florida making it harder for third-party groups to register people to vote. The League of Women Voters, Rock the Vote, these nonpartisan groups, they have all these onerous new requirements now. They have to hand in voter registration forms within 48 hours or face $1,000 fines. They have to do incredibly complicated.
Wait, what does that mean? They have to hand it in within 48 hours. They have to hand it in within 48 hours of it being signed?
Absolutely. Originally, they had to hand it in person, which in a huge state like Florida would have been absolutely impossible. After lobbying from groups like the Brennan Center and others, now you can mail those in, but it's still a very quick turnaround for a volunteer. And not only that, there's all these new bureaucratic requirements in terms of having to register with the state, having to constantly update your information, that for a volunteer group like the League of Women Voters is just way too burdensome to actually be able to comply with. I mean, basically, you need a PhD in voter registration to be able to pull this off in a state like Florida. And as a result, you're just seeing groups like the League of Women Voters saying, it's too much trouble, it's going to cost us too much money, we could be prosecuted as felony criminals for making an honest mistake, and thus they're just shutting down operations as a result, which I think is exactly what Florida Republicans wanted out of the law.
Right, mission accomplished. And of course, they're disenfranchising more and more felons as well. People
Absolutely.
Who have been,
well,
come out of prison, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, people who have served their time. What happened in Florida is Charlie Crist said that people who have served their time should have their voting rights restored. 154,000 prisoners had their right restored who had been convicted of nonviolent crimes and had served their time, rehabilitated back into society. After 30 minutes of public debate, Florida Governor Rick Scott overturned Crist's decision, which instantly disenfranchised 97,000 ex-felons and prevents another 1 million from being able to get their rights after they get out. There's this very lengthy process now where they have to apply, and then it's up to the parole board whether they want to even grant the rights after this 5 to 7 year waiting period. So essentially, he's permanently disenfranchised 1 million voters as a result of this. The same thing happened in Iowa. There's fewer felons there, and there's fewer felons of color there, but still you're talking about 100,000 people who got the right to vote under Tom Vilsack, the previous governor, now overturned by Governor Terry Branstad. And that's basically just saying you can't vote at all, which goes beyond photo ID. It goes beyond making it harder to vote. These people just can't vote anymore. And that's pretty serious in terms of disenfranchising people who previously were eligible to vote.
Now, so, I mean, what can be done about this? I mean, you know, the interesting thing to me is that Digby had pointed out a piece from this guy, Matthew Vadim, writing in, I guess it was, I don't know, if in the American Thinker of all places, basically saying that, well, let me quote it. It is profoundly antisocial and un-American to empower the non-productive segment of the population to destroy the country, which is precisely why Barack Obama zealously supports registering welfare recipients to vote. Encouraging those who burden society to participate in elections isn't about helping the poor. I mean, fundamentally, there is a strain within the Republican Party that just believes that, you know, we should not have everybody eligible to vote because certain classes of people just don't deserve it, which, of course, is fundamentally anti-American. There's another, obviously, I think a greater portion of the Republican Party, which is, you know, really like this is going to just simply help us. And who cares about disenfranchising these people? What can be done here? I mean,
first off, that's the same rhetoric that Dixiecrats used to prevent black people from voting before the Civil Rights Act, before the Voting Rights Act. So, I mean, that's
and I don't think that's a coincidence.
It's
I mean, frankly, I don't think that's a coincidence. I mean, I think they feel like, look, even still, we don't come out and say that they should be barred because of their skin color. We should just come out and say that, you know, now we're going to take it, a level deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. So a few things can be done. I mean, number one, the Justice Department has to review all the different laws that fall under the purview of the Voting Rights Act. So that's something that the Justice Department will be looking at very closely. A lot of these third-party groups, a lot of campaigns are going to have to basically do voter education efforts to make people aware of what's going on and to help them get these IDs to the extent possible. That's going to be a major component of it. There's certain states where this legislation is in flux and could be overturned. Ohio is one state where they're gathering signatures to overturn the law. Maine's another state where they're gathering signatures to overturn the law. There's lawsuits that have been filed by groups in Missouri and Florida and Wisconsin, and there'll probably be more lawsuits coming down the pike. So there's a few different possibilities here, but there's no doubt that this is going to be an issue that remains somewhat in flux for the next little bit. And unless there's a concerted effort by either Justice Department, the courts, or these partisan nonprofit groups or political campaigns to try to right what's been going on, there's going to be a lot of chaos at the polls and a lot of people not being able to vote in the 2012 election.
And that's just one of the, impediments to Obama's reelection that he's facing. I want to just turn now because it's a great piece. People can check that piece out in Rolling Stone. It's great reporting. But I wanted to talk about just a little bit. I want to get a little bit. I don't know if it's meta or I want to just sort of change a little bit to I want you to don your professional leftist hat for a moment. And
I've
don't know.
I've taken my reporter cap off.
All right. Take your reporter cap off and put that. I don't know if you saw this piece. This weekend, I guess it was in the Times Magazine. If you didn't, you probably can guess, you know, more or less what it is. It was by Jonathan Chait, as you inform me, is how he pronounces his name, of the New Republic, What the Left Doesn't Understand About Obama. And he goes on to basically say that the left engages in magical thinking and that they believe Obama could be doing stuff and better or more liberal or on both a policy and rhetorical plane that he's not doing. And the left is just, gosh, they're just so involved in magical thinking. Fairies and pixie dust and cotton candy skies and whatnot. And, this is not atypical of Jonathan Chait. He's made a living hippie punching. Cheerleading for the centrist and responsible establishment positions from his perch at the New Republic. But and just if you haven't read the piece, just accept my assessment of that piece. What does it say about his argument when we have just literally 3 days after he writes that Obama's poll numbers are in the toilet? And not just amongst liberals, but amongst everyone. I mean, what does it say about that theory that this guy gets into the New York Times to write this hippie punching theory when, in fact, all that it shows is that the liberal activists are nothing more than canaries in the coal mine? They are undoubtedly the most attuned to what's going on from a political perspective.
Yeah. So a few things, Sam. I mean, number one, it's been comical to watch some of these pundits like Chait basically rationalize the inaction of the Obama administration. I mean, essentially, for a year, the administration has been pursuing this strategy of trying to remain above the fray, focus on independent voters, be the quote-unquote most reasonable person in the room, and show that they are as serious about cutting spending and tackling the deficit as the Republicans supposedly are. And we've seen the result of that strategy, that it has been an absolute catastrophic disaster. And Democrats and those on the left have been saying for a long time, you've got to focus on jobs. And the administration keeps making arguments, and their enablers in the punditocracy keep making arguments for why the administration should not have focused on jobs. And look where we are today. We're at a position where instead of focusing on jobs in the end of 2010 when they still had the majority, or instead of focusing on jobs at the beginning of 2011, Obama has let a year slip away with no focus on jobs. The second thing here is that all that the so-called professional left has done is to try to hold Obama to his word, right, Sam? He said he wanted public option, go fight for it. He said he wanted the EPA to crack down on smog, go fight for it. He said he wanted to do all these various things, go fight for it. And time again, Obama has not fought for the stated policies that he says he supports. And so if you're an Obama-enabling pundit, you should at least, at the very minimum, want him to fight for the very things that he says are so important, right? And if he doesn't fight for them, you should say, why isn't he fighting for them? And you shouldn't blame the left for the reason that Obama is not fighting, is not pushing for his policies. And this is what I find curious. I mean, we can argue about what Obama has and hasn't done, but essentially, we are just saying, okay, you said you're for this. Now go out and try to do it. And in a lot of cases, they haven't even tried to have this fight, or they've adopted the very rhetoric of the right on the economy, which has really undermined not only his presidency, but the entire progressive community writ large.
Let's break this down a little bit, because, you know, there's two different sort of, I guess, critiques of President Obama. One is from a policy standpoint, and one is from a rhetorical standpoint. And the argument from a guy like Chait is that from a policy standpoint, he's accomplished a lot of things, and anything he couldn't accomplish was impossible. And nothing that he could have done different would have been the case. If you just stipulate that for a moment, and I don't necessarily agree with that, but if you stipulate that for a moment, they are completely discounting the value of politics in laying down and creating a broader narrative, an ideological narrative, that even if policy achievements weren't possible now, they could be 4 or 5 years from now, except for he is strengthening the political hand of those who oppose those policies. So the 4 or 5 years down the road, that cannot happen. And
yeah, I mean, I think they go hand in hand, quite frankly.
I
do
too.
Rhetoric and the policy goes hand in hand. I think if Obama had made a sustained case for the stimulus bill, for why we needed more stimulus, for the role of government in a time of crisis, for bold policies that could have helped working Americans, if he had stuck by that and made that argument over and over and over, I think we would have gotten some stuff through, at least a Democratic Congress, that would have been more visionary than it had been. And if he hadn't been able to get it through a Republican Congress, at least he would be putting forth an argument to counter the Republican argument. But now he's completely boxed in. He's in the worst of both worlds, right, Sam? He hasn't been pushing for progressive policies, and he hasn't been making a progressive argument on the economy either. So what's happened is the public is more responsive to conservative arguments, because that's the only argument they hear, the argument that austerity will boost the economy, that cutting spending will boost the economy, even though there's absolutely no evidence that that's true. And number two, Obama's been boxed in politically because that argument has become so profound that now that he's pivoted to jobs a year or 2 years too late, there's no political support for the kind of things that he wants to do, or not as much political support as there would have been. So absolutely, we've seen that by embracing the Republican argument on the economy, Obama has actually shifted public opinion. So if he had embraced the progressive argument on the economy, he could have perhaps shifted public opinion in that direction. And the fact that he didn't even try is what's so curious here. You could have said, okay, he tried and he failed, but he didn't even try, and so it's basically impossible to prove a counterfactual on this right now.
Right, and we know that even if he tried and failed, he at least has set the predicate that there is a that if – I mean, because look, the bottom line is if the stimulus had not passed when it passed and they had said we're going to go for a $1.3 or $1.5 trillion stimulus – and it has not passed, 6 months down the road, the pressure to do something would have been so great that they probably would have had a chance to pass something like that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If they would have just explained the stimulus in clear numbers, that this is the fact, okay?
You have an output gap of $2 trillion. You need to fill that hole.
Exactly. Basically, they could have – I understand there was political constraints on the first stimulus, but let's just say, okay, fine. It was very clear in August 2010 that the stimulus was not big enough and the economy was slumping back into a recession. And you had progressive groups and Democratic leaders going to President Obama and saying, you have to push for jobs, and said, no, we'll offend independent voters. We can't do that. We got to get serious about cutting spending. So from a year onwards, they focused on cutting spending, not talking about jobs, not selling the stimulus, not selling another stimulus, no government role in the economy, just cutting jobs, cutting spending. And this is where we're at. We're at President Obama's approval rating at an all-time low. We're at the recession back in full force. We're at a possibility that there's no room to maneuver. Obama has to give a job speech followed by a deficit speech. I mean, that's crazy. That's like canceling out. One that cancels out the other. So, I mean, I just find it – I mean, how does John Chait rationalize the fact that Obama's doing so poorly? Is it really the left's fault? I mean, I don't see how you can find any evidence based on the last year of how Obama has governed.
See, I mean, that is the other thing, too, is I would like to hear from John Chait who it is that has the right idea here. I mean, because we know that the Republicans, and that is the premise of his piece, essentially, that the Republicans are knee-jerk in opposition to President Obama. They're crazy. They're just going to be obstacles. So why has President Obama lost everyone else? According to Jonathan Chait, it would have to be because liberals did not get on board with his policies, and which is just absurd, because liberals don't even have the capacity to push their own supposed liberal progressive legislators in the right place. How could they possibly be impacting the rest of the policy? I mean, the rest of the public opinion on Obama. I mean, clearly what we see again is that the liberal activist base is in fact more of a bellwether than anything else. I mean,
certainly on the economy. I mean, basically.
But look at it. I mean, I'm talking about over the past 10 years. I mean, if you look about it in terms of Iraq, if you look about it in terms of Joe Lieberman, I mean, because Joe Lieberman won because there was a deficit of a Republican candidate in Connecticut. Had there been a real Republican candidate, you'd have Ned Lamont, as bad of a campaigner as he was, he'd be the senator of Connecticut. If you look at the stimulus, if you look at jobs, if you look at anything down, if you look at the public's disposition towards the healthcare reform, time and time again, the progressive liberal activist base has been nothing but a bellwether for where public opinion was going to go. I mean, there is just multiple examples of this over and over and over again. And yet you have people like Jonathan Chait in there as if they're protecting literally only their job.
No, I mean, it is surprising. I mean, it's surprising to me that you would have a pundit making this argument. I mean, I can understand a paid Obama advisor making this argument, but I have a hard time seeing someone like Jonathan Chait, who's a smart guy. I'm just having trouble seeing why they are blaming Obama's problems on the left when it's been very, very obvious that Obama has not governed as a leftist president, certainly not in the last year, has not listened to the left, and his entire strategy has been in opposition to the left, right, Sam? I mean, his entire strategy of being the most reasonable person in the room has been to push off the left and say, I'm fighting my own party. And it's gotten him absolutely nowhere. I mean, he's losing support among independent voters, and he's losing support among Democratic and progressive voters. And really, the reason he's doing so badly in the polls right now is because his numbers are starting to crater among his own base. And that's who he needs to hold. In 2004, George W. Bush was not a popular president, but he held his own base and was managed to squeak by. And that really should be the lesson for Obama in 2012. A lot of the country's not going to like him, but if he can hold on to his own group of people and just persuade enough of the country that what he did was the best course of action, then he can probably squeak out the election. But if he turns his back on the very people that worked so hard for him in 2008, then he's going to have absolutely no chance in 2012.
And I can't emphasize this enough. When we say that he has turned his back on his base, he's not just choosing policies that happen to be different from what his base wants. If his base was not in opposition to that, he would create it as part of a strategy. In other words, if there was no liberals crying out like, hey, we don't like what you're doing, he would create that because according to his strategy, which is to be seen as being in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I basically think every single time until perhaps very recently when the base has been mad, I think Obama's advisors have been happy. I mean, I think that's how they want to position him for 2012. I think they're belatedly realizing that that's not a good strategy because what's happening is they're losing independent voters anyway, and then what the base wants and what independent voters want is the exact same thing, which is you need to start creating jobs, you need to get the economy moving, and if you don't do that, then no amount of hippie punching will save you for 2012.
Ari Berman of The Nation magazine, his piece is in Rolling Stone. We will link to it on the blog at Majority FM. Ari, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're out of time. We've got to move to the better half of the show. And man, oh man, we got a lot of stories in the better half of the show today. More on this myth that regulations kill jobs. Update on this anonymous protest on later this month. Europe, a disaster area, about to get more disastery. And this really horrible story with of another person dying, essentially because they couldn't pay for a simple dental checkup and antibiotics. Just a horrible story. I will briefly touch on this story of the spy case where America is spying on Israel and the sort of real story behind that. And it turns out that the airport, I don't know, 15 minutes from me up in Columbia County, was used by the CIA for its extraordinary rendition. This case, it's unbelievable. It was a lawsuit in Columbia County. Nobody paid attention to it. And there could be a treasure trove of documents in this lawsuit that let us know more about extraordinary rendition. All this and more on the better half of the show. Folks, I don't have time to read you the email right now, but I got an email from some dude in Australia who says, like, you know, because your American supporters won't support your show, I guess I'll have to. Do you understand that you folks in America being upstaged by the descendants of criminals? Criminals are supporting this show. You can become a member at Majority FM. It's your patriotic duty. You can also support the show by buying your junk on through our Amazon link, by donating your account at donateyouraccount.com/MajorityFM. By giving us a good rating on iTunes. You listen through it. Why not just go over there, get us 5 stars, say it's great. And, of course, justcoffee.coop. Buy your coffee, tea, chocolate there. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get a 10% discount. See you on the better half.